write more about the books in that newsletter. Ed Morris is now the new editor of that.
Well, I don't know. Well, now, let me continue what I was saying. We have two things. We have a culture which is spookological. Our civilization is built on myths. And then, on the other hand, we are technicians. We have science in which we have people working on things, events, and they describe them and so on. Well, now, it's very easy for someone to see that if you're going to be interested in psychology, for example, you know it's a study of behavior, and just as the physicist studies behavior, just as the chemist studies behavior of different specific kinds of events. And that's the whole secret of it. I knew everybody when I was very young. Whenever anybody hears something, they hear something. I mean, they see something. But then when you read, when you're in science, that is the cultural science, they cut everything out, and they talk about light rays, and they talk about physiological things, and of course, it all fits in with the spookology. I'll tell you a little story. After I was retired from Indiana, I taught at the New York University, and I taught at the University of Maryland. At the University of Maryland, the one of the last graduate classes I ever had, we were discussing interbehavioral psychology, and one of the subjects was perception we were studying. And so one of the students, they were all graduates and some very close to PhD. They mentioned that they had read Gildard. That was one thing they had studied. And that was the opening for something. I said, will they bring a book at another meeting? And they did. And so I read to them a passage from the book that brought human, what was the name of it, Human Sensation or something like that. Well, they said, and then I went to the board and I said, all right, now here's the light ray. And here is the retina, here is the impulse, it goes to the brain. Where's the color? There's no color. Newton said there's no color in the light rays. He knew that. And so, but he, of course, was a spookologist, and he said, well, that the brain produced the color. And they said, I made it out to be, of course, quite a bad situation. And they said, I never heard of that. Nobody ever told us. And here there were PhDs. And what are they going to do? They're going to tell the same damn lies.
Okay.
And then, you know, I remember what I said at the beginning. Atkinson and Hilgard say, if you teach behavior, that's not good. You have to give them both, spookology and anti-spookology.
But how did you leave your culture?
Pardon?
How did you leave your cultural tradition?
How did I?
What did you contact intellectually that enabled you to depart from your cultural tradition?
Well, that gets to be personal, but, but I don't mind telling you. You know, my parents were immigrants, and they belonged to an entirely different kind of culture. And then I had to accommodate myself to this culture. And I don't mind telling you, I couldn't read English until I was 9 years old. My parents didn't send me to school. And so I became quite sensitive to things. And then I could see that what I wanted was the scientific side, not this culture of science, but science based on observation of actual events.
Because that's what you mostly did, was observe.
Pardon?
Mostly what you did was observe, because you didn't talk with people very much.
I didn't quite get why. You said I didn't talk to
you. You didn't talk with people very much because you couldn't speak or write the
language. Oh, I could speak. I was bilingual. I could speak, but I couldn't read. But I made up for it. Every day, I went to the library and got a new book, finished it. And then the next day, I got another book. I just became fascinated with English, and so... But the fundamental thing is events versus tradition. I don't know if you've ever noticed a little piece I wrote about two biologists who wrote letters to science. And they said that scientists should not be so hard on the cult, on the evolutionists, on the creationists.
Oh, okay.
Did you read the two of them? High-grade biologists. And one of them said they think that the scientists should be more careful about creation, because he says, I believe in evolution, but I'm a Christian. But don't record much more, because I'm getting personal.
Did your parents give you religious training?
Pardon?
Did your parents give you religious training at all?
Give me what?
I would assume that you did not receive proper training in your religion.
In religion?
In your religion. I didn't in mine, I must admit. Fortunately.
It was the opposite. It was full of religion. It was full of religion.
It was full of shalom alechems and alechem shaloms, huh?
It seems to me a very easy, plain thing that, you see, there are now quite a few people who write this way. They say that science of the wrong kind does harm to our knowledge. Like these two biologists, you see.
Maybe somebody should collect all the creation myths and put them into one book, you know, and say, here's creation science. What do they call it? Creation science or creationism?
Creationism.
Creationism. Yeah, here it is. Take your pick from all of these.
Two presidents ago here, we had a man by the name of Beadle. He was a botanist, and he was from the California Institute, and they took him here and made him president for 7 years or so. And he was a prize winner.
Nobel Prize winner?
Nobel Prize. He went downtown while he was president and made a speech at the Liberal Christian Society. And this is what he said, and I can show you, I have the clipping. This is what he said. He said, "I am an evolutionist. I believe in evolution." He said, "But you go back to the time when the scientific doctrine is that there was only hydrogen. That was the first element. The hydrogen made helium and so on, and everything is developed of all the complicated animals and so on. He believes in that. But he said, who made the hydrogen? We don't know. Who made the hydrogen? And his speech was, there is no conflict between science and religion. Well, anybody can see that. I don't have to be any special person to see what's going on. That's what we're having. And you know, the Hilgard Atkinson books, they're the best sellers in psychology books, and Atkinson and Hilgard are making a big fortune out of that. And see what's being taught, what are you going to get out of those students in the way of education?
I always say that the psychologist that's the most popular is the one that tells people what they already know. You don't tell them what they already know.
No. You see, I've often said that when a student comes to psychology class, he already knows psychology. He knows the brain. He may not know that the brain's a computer, but he soon learns that. And then he knows all that business. Yeah. Because psychology, being the study of organisms and interaction, it's such a common thing. And that's in the culture.
Well, turning back for a moment, when you came to begin graduate school, were you interested in psychology or philosophy? Did you want to specialize in philosophy or psychology when you began graduate school?
Well, that again is a little bit personal, but it doesn't matter. I had three majors for my PhD. I don't mind telling you this. I was a little late starting, you see, and I covered everything in psychology, everything in philosophy, and in biology, and I was a medical student, you see. And so I was always interested in scientific work, scientific attitude, and so on. My philosophy is psychology, you know. It's based on naturalistic psychology. And there isn't such difference between psychology. I wrote a little paper once to show the difference, different attitudes. At first, of course, psychology in this country even was old philosophy, the Christian philosophy. All right, and then they wanted to get away from philosophy, but they never did. There never has been any such thing as psychology being away from philosophy. Hildegard is simply building on the conventional philosophy and psychology and all the others. Well, now they're coming back. They say you have to know. And Turner wrote a little book, not such a little book. Do you know it? It's on...
History?
No, it's called Psychology and Philosophy.
Yes, it was in the Century of Psychology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's in...
the Appleton Century Cross series?
Yes.
About 67.
Yes.
67.
And what he does is to put in a little bit of... the analytic philosophy, which is, of course, spookology. There never has been any kind of philosophy. I remember one time at a meeting, I met a man, I can't tell you now who he was, and I wouldn't know. And then when we met, he said, you're the philosopher, philosophy psychologist. At that time, it was an insult.
Do you remember the man Watson?
What?
Do you remember Watson at all?
Watson? Well, you know, he wasn't here anymore when I came.
Yeah.
But he came summers. And I met him. I knew him. Summers. And then one time I visited him at when he was teaching in New York at the...
Columbia?
No, New School. He never taught at Columbia. Well, he may have lectured there, but he...
Yes.
And he invited me to talk to his class. And then he said I was more of a structuralist than he was. Yes, I remember him.
Did he have much charisma?
What?
Did he have much charisma when he talked? Was he an orator?
I didn't quite get...
Did Watson have much charisma? Did he talk like an orator?
Oh, charisma. Oh, yes, he was a fine southern gentleman.
Oh.
Yes. I had a course with him one summer, and he used to come in the summer with gloves and a stick. I used to go to the faculty exchange, get his mail, and then the psychology department was close, and then he'd come into the classroom, take off his gloves, and put down his stick, and then begin to talk. He was a fine, fine man in that respect. He was a brilliant man, but of course he was bred in the old schools. He came to Chicago to study philosophy, you know, but Dewey's philosophy.
Dewey's back.
That kind of philosophy, not naturalistic philosophy. Nobody ever
reflex
heard of it.
Reflex arc, right.
Pardon?
The reflex arc.
Yeah.
Back to the matter of distribution of your books. I noticed you had a very nice brochure made up.
A
with
catalog.
Principia Press, or a catalog. Yes, do you have copies of that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now that's something that could be distributed in some fashion or another. Have you distributed that at all?
Well, as I said, I'm too busy to do things like that. Mm-hmm. But we have done something of that sort. And in the course of time, the public has had criticisms of me. And for one thing, they said, when you mentioned it a while ago, it was difficult. The writing was difficult. I had a fine review of two books by Schoenfeld. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, excellent, yes.
And he mentions that, and that's mentioned at many times. And then there's another one, which is not experimental. And so, people don't know. You see, all experiments are interbehavioral experiments.
Yes.
Nobody can do an experiment because the original data are all fields, all complicated. So that's what you have to work with. Well, those are the two things that have stood in the way. But of course, behind that, I believe, well, this is just a belief, that, you see, it is a fight against the culture. And that's what matters. Now that we're telling stories, I'll tell you another story. It's been an uphill fight all the way from the beginning. At Indiana University, around 1930s, we had a chairman whose stupidity could hardly be matched. We had a situation there which was quite good. Every person who taught elementary psychology could use whatever book he wanted to use. Then when I wrote the survey, there was objection. And he said, the general public, the teachers used to use Woodworth. Mm-hmm. And his basic formula is S-O-R. Well, and full of the old standard spookology. And so this chairman said, you know, at first you have to teach them facts. And afterwards you can teach them some theory. Well, it was an uphill fight, and still is.
Is.
But there's some humor in it.
What did you think of factor analysis, or what is your assessment of factor analysis? I know that... as I recall. And he was a student of Thurston. He worked in Thurston's laboratory where they were developing the factor analysis work.
Well,
I was wondering your opinion of factor analysis is.
Well, factor analysis, you see, is all right. But the question is, what postulates do you use?
Mm-hmm.
You see, mm-hmm. there's a man by the name of Stevenson. Have you run into
him? Oh, yes.
He's the man. Well, in about 1953, he wrote a book in which he's an interbehaviorist. But he wasn't quite certain about it. And then he mentioned Bentley. And he didn't know that Bentley, you see, was just a newspaper man. And he was a rich man. And he was a PhD in sociology of long ago, and so he wanted to he moved away from Chicago, where he worked as a newspaper man, and he went down to Indiana, 40 miles away from Bloomington,
mm-hmm.
and he met for one thing the mathematician by the name of, I can't say his name for the moment, but then this mathematician was acquainted with me, and he introduced us. And what he wanted to do, you see, was to learn something and then to try and find some little feature that he could add to it, and then he would become somebody. And he did. My story about him would make a book, because I knew him a long time, and there are a lot of things about him. Well, basically, he joined up with Dewey in their old ages, and they were working for firm terms. Do you know about the firm terms they wanted to get?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they were wanting to do is to get back to Hegel and his absolute, you see. So they wanted firm terms. And science doesn't doesn't welcome firm terms, and it isn't interested in terms; it's interested in events. Well, so there you have that kind of thing, and because he went for Dewey, Dewey was a great man, and although. Before Bentley joined him, he used to make fun of him and point out how Dewey was so sensitive to fakers. You know about that.
No.
There was one man by the name of Alexander who wrote a book about curing people in certain ways. He was a fraud. But Dewey sponsored him and said he was a fine man and he has fine ideas. But Bentley told us that every library has a whole little corner where they have the fakes that Dewey fostered. Although he was a great man and did some great things, but of course then he never really got away from the old spookology. Well, that's the way things are.
Principia published Bentley's Behavior Knowledge Fact, right?
Yes, yes.
Is that ever going to be in print?
Well, actually, I helped to make him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what he was trying to do at first, he had published a book which was a good book in 1908, and excuse me, called it something about politics. Mm-hmm. And the University of Chicago published the book, but didn't sell, and it was in the basement where he lived. So I told him that he should take it out of the basement and put it into the Principia Press. I was the editor. And then it got fine circulation, and there was some lawyer here, quite an eminent lawyer, who praised it and thought it was a fine book. It was. I once introduced Bentley to a little group and said that he had published a classic work, and he got angry. He wanted everything to be classic, that he did. And so he did the behavior of knowledge and fact, and we published another book of his, the Logical Analysis of Mathematics. Mm-hmm. Oh, he took a lot of my time, but I was willing because, well, in the final analysis, he used to come to my house because I lived in Bloomington and he lived in Paoli. That was just down the state. And he had money and he could go any place and do anything he wanted to. So I had a little daughter. He was a big man, Falstaff, you know, that's the picture of him. And when he laughed, you could see his belly go. And she liked to see him.
Do you think Principia is Principia, the press, is that going to open its doors at all to other publications, or it will just do your stuff?
Well, at one time, this mathematician, Davis, was his name, and I started him. He wrote a book in 1930 or something like that on the new mathematics and the new science or something like that. And that was in the Deep Depression. Nobody could publish any book who didn't have the promise of large sales.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he's, don't remember, you see, it's been long ago, whether he had tried several publishers. And anyway, we got together and we said, we'll publish ourselves, we'll start a press. And we did. And he had quite a little publicity. It was a fine idea that he had, and he was showing how this new physics was fitting in with the thinking of the time. So that was all right. And then he did the most of the work because I was editor, but. I simply passed on the books that he got. So he got a lot of people who were members of the university.
Oh.
And most of them maybe were theses. I remember one book was called something like One Body and Souls Twain or something. It was a book on some literary person. And we had quite a list of books. One incident you might be interested in was that a professor at Indiana University had some connection with Columbia University, And they were in competition with the Principia Press to publish this book on foraminifera. And that's a big subject, because oil, you see, is developed by foraminifera. And so we got the, we published the book, not Columbia. So there was, that was one of the games that I was interested in. I never was interested in athletics or anything else of that sort.
Do you think you'll ever do it again and have other books published through Principia, or just your own stuff?
No, it's only my books. I'll bring down the catalog and you'll see. We have another book that was, after 1 year, the Principia Press became a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had five directors, five men. One of them was the dean of the graduate school. He had published a book on education. He called it an open letter to college teachers. And so we still keep that, and that's the only one.
The cost must be very high for production.
Pardon?
The cost. The money for production must be very expensive.
Yes, we had no capital, and we made no profits, and the authors had to underwrite the costs. And we did very well. We had books that were quite classics, famous. Another one, Davis was not a highly creative mathematician. He was a teacher of mathematics. But he wrote four books, I think, on collections of of functions that mathematicians and others would use. He had, I think, four volumes. And then he had a book called Alexandria, the Golden City, because he was interested in Alexandria and the library there and so on.
It's a shame it wasn't an inner behavioral application of looking at Alexandria.
Well, it didn't have much to do with anything that I was interested in especially. But we did have a big list, and then he left Indiana University and went to Northwestern University.
Oh.
And so Edison. So then we split, and I kept my books, and he went on.
That's what I would do. I would keep my property.
And then he, after he retired from Northwestern, he went down to Texas, to a place called Trinity University in San Antonio, and then finally he sold the. His
portion.
Part to the university there. It's a religious school, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I'll tell you one joke about the situation. When we had the meeting to break the press, he said, without thinking maybe, he said, I should take my books out. And then he would keep the press. And that wasn't a good thing. So I said to him, look, we'll copy Standard Oil. So you call your press the Standard, the Principia Press of Illinois. And ours would be the Principia Press of Indiana. And that's what he did.
Oh, he did.
But then he sold his part to that university, and they called it the Principia Press of Trinity University. And but since then they dropped the Principia Press.
So it's just Trinity.
Now it's Trinity University Press.
Oh, that's something. I didn't realize that. Yeah, I just spoke a second ago about applications. An area that has not heard much about a natural psychology is clinical. And we're putting some stuff together, hopefully, for a book that shows applications using inner behavioral in clinical and educational areas. What do you think about that idea?
Well, you see, now, there's only one person who runs the press, and we couldn't...
I just mean in general, the idea. Not for you to publish it, just the idea itself of...
I see. And we get letters occasionally from people who have finished books, and they want to the press to consider publishing it. See, people think that we're a real publisher, and we're not, of course.
Just the area itself, the area of clinical and inner behavioral stuff. Does that sound like it's an area that hasn't been looked at very closely?
Oh, yes.
Here, what Doug is saying is that there are now a number of psychologists who have been influenced by interbehavioral psychology and who are practicing psychology as clinical psychologists.
Yes.
And what Doug has been talking about is putting together a collection of original articles by these psychologists, and he's in fact potentially found another publisher.
So
what he's asking is just what do you think of the general idea of tying interbehaviorism more fully to clinical application?
Well,
in other words, you have influenced certain clinical psychologists, and where these are the core, for example, Sid Bijou, Waller. Do you know Waller from Tennessee?
Yeah.
Robert Waller, who recently has published some very important clinical work based upon the concept of setting events. Are you familiar with that?
No, I don't know the book.
He has a number of articles.
Oh.
Robert Waller, W-A-H-L-E-R. Have you run into any of his work?
No, I haven't. I don't know.
Oh,
well,
okay.
The idea is a good idea.
Yeah.
But we couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah. Robert Waller is very influential in child behavior therapy, and he has published a number of articles now in which he has discussed the clinical implications of your concept of setting events. Much as Bijou and Bear, he's extended Bijou and Bear's application of setting events in their child development book.
Yeah.
So, in other words, what has happened in very recent years is that there's definitely been more and more clinical psychologists influenced by interbehaviorism. I myself, for example, I'm a licensed psychologist, even though I'm also an experimental psychologist. And the training that I do, the clinical training I do, is interbehaviorally based. And that's the foundations of the work that I do. And what people are doing now is thinking of putting together getting this more organized. In other words, the whole notion of foundations, the whole notion of foundations is very elementary in psychology. Most psychologists practice without foundations. Right? Or with spookyology foundations.
Uh-huh.
And for the first time, we have psychologists who are practicing, who are very excited about the possibility of an authentic naturalistic foundation, namely interbehaviorism, to their practice. And this is what's happening now.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
That sounds very interesting.
Paul Fuller.
I don't want to mark down the name. I may know the name, but I can't usually hear it.
I'll do that. We'll do that right now.
Oh, yes.
Wish I could give a particular reference.
You can give him the Java. It's in the journal.
I know. It's W-A-H-L-E-R, right? And it's university.